This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the life and the political career of Strom Thurmond. When he left office at the age of 100, no one had spent more years as a member of the United States Senate. He was first elected to public office in 1929 as a Democrat. Years later, he switched parties in the 60s, becoming a Republican. He is probably best known for his strong opposition to civil rights. In fact, he set a filibuster record in the Senate when he spoke against the 1957 Civil Rights Act, and that record, I believe that it is 24 hours and 18 minutes, that record still stands. However, as national attitudes changed, so did he. And in fact, in 1982, he voted to extend the Voting Rights Act, something he had opposed in 1965. In the 70s, he became a champion of historically black colleges. In 1983, he supported legislation to make the holiday, to make a national holiday of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. The biggest story of his life, however, broke not long after his death when a woman named Essie Mae Washington Williams confirmed what had been the subject of rumors for a long time, that as a young man, Strom Thurmond had fathered a daughter with his family's black maid, and that she, Essie Mae, was that daughter. This morning in this part of the program, we'll be talking with a journalist who spent quite a lot of time covering Strom Thurmond, Marilyn Thompson. She is the co-author, along with Jack Bass, of a biography of Strom Thurmond that has recently been updated and published in paperback. The book is titled Strom, The Complicated Personal and Political Life of Strom Thurmond. Public Affairs is the publisher on the book. Marilyn Thompson is in the process of switching jobs. She was the vice president and editor of the Lexington Herald Leader, and she's now getting ready to pack up and move to Washington, D.C., where next month she will become the national investigations editor of the Los Angeles Times, based in Washington, D.C., and she's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. And also, we have that toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, comments, you can give us a call. Again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ms. Thompson, hello.
Yes, hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Certainly.
You know, looking at Strom Thurmond's life and looking at the positions that he took over time and looking at how things changed, particularly how later in life his views on segregation and on civil rights changed, one wonders whether over time he was acting on what he actually believed, what he truly believed, or whether, to put it bluntly, he was a kind of a political opportunist, and that he was he had his finger up in the wind and was gauging which way it went, and when things changed, he changed. Which of those do you think is more true?
Well, in my opinion, David, the political opportunist tag fit Thurmond absolutely perfectly. Dating back to his very earliest years in politics when he was a very young man, he was extremely adept at sensing the political mood, the political climate, and making adjustments to fit that change. His views on race certainly fit that model perfectly. And he did make a shift, and it was a very profound shift in things that he would say publicly and do on the floor of the Senate and in his office to help black constituents. But in my view, it was an opportunistic triumph.
Hmm. So his you think his true attitudes about race never really changed?
I felt that his true attitudes about race never changed, and I thought that it was very telling that while Thurmond found many, many ways to defend and explain his states' rights campaign of 1948, he never really apologized for it. He found ways to spin it to a campaign on, you know, Jeffersonian states' rights principles, and had a very elaborate explanation for it. but he never truly realized how hurtful that this campaign and the rhetoric that he used on the campaign trail had been to African Americans during that time.
Mm-hmm. You, in the introduction to the book, you have a neat paragraph here where you say that his success in politics was built basically on four things: political boldness, which I'll read the way it's a nice paragraph. Political boldness, which reflects both courage and an unsurpassed instinct for timing, a refusal to keep an enemy, which dissipates opposition, a willingness to take a firm stand on issues, which generates respect, and a record of legendary constituent service, which generates goodwill. I wonder if you could take each of those points and perhaps give an example.
Sure. Political boldness. Let's start with that one. And again, to talk for just a moment about the states' rights campaign. Thurman was governor when the idea of presenting himself as a states' rights Dixiecrat candidate first came up. And it was an act of political boldness that would be very hard to describe today. I mean, he was literally placing his political longevity on the line by agreeing to run a campaign that could be political suicide, and he knew that. His advisors had counseled him on that, but he did it anyway, and he did it because he felt that it was the right thing to do.
Okay, so then the next thing would be refusal to keep an enemy.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. I think about that because we have a governor here in Kentucky right now, Ernie Fletcher, who is under indictment in a misdemeanor case. And Fletcher has so many political enemies, and he does nothing to try to win them over. Thurman adopted the philosophy that it would be to his advantage to go back and patch up things with virtually everyone that he had ever crossed. And he did that routinely. He truly believed that it was to his advantage to make the phone call, to offer the gesture of conciliation.
Mm-hmm. I think a little bit later here, you quote someone, an anonymous person on the street, someone who the text refers to as a textile worker. Textile worker in overalls once explained he'd vote for Thurman because, quote, he stands up for what he believes in, even when he's wrong.
Yeah.
So that, I guess that goes to this fourth point about the willingness to take a firm stand on issues, the kind of thing that people seem to, again, a thing that always gained him a lot of support.
Right. Thurman, when he decided to dive into an issue, he did so with considerable vigor. And one example might be his crusade to keep Abe Fortas from becoming the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Many people, many observers believe that what Thurman did to Abe Fortas during Senate hearings was just outrageous. I mean, he was like an attack dog. But he did, in fact, push it to the limit, even if he was wrong in doing so.
And the last thing, and this is the kind of thing that can never hurt a politician, I'm sure, is that he was apparently very, very good at doing constituent service.
That was Thurman's masterful stroke. He just knew how to work his constituents. He identified with them. He spoke their language. The textile worker that you just cited being one of the many, many thousands of people who felt personally connected to this man. Thurman had a policy in his office of writing notes to people who had babies and who lost relatives and who graduated from high school and graduated from college. We even found these sort of standard form letters written to the daughters and son of his black daughter. He just did it for everybody. And it was a way of winning people over. You could always cite that letter that you had from Strom Thurmond with his big scrawl of a signature at the bottom, and it meant something to you. I have one in my office, as a matter of fact.
I have a couple of callers that I want to get to. Maybe just let me ask one more question. You can talk for a minute about that, then we may well come back to it. I think that he is certainly noteworthy for a number of things, for his political longevity, for one thing, certainly for his the place that he had in American politics in a sort of general sense, but in Southern politics in particular, and in the growth of support, particularly in the growth of support for the Republican Party in the South.
Right.
Maybe you can talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, I think that that probably is his most lasting contribution to the American political landscape. He literally led the South to the Republican Party and did so during Barry Goldwater's campaign, when he made a very famous switchover from Democrat to Republican to support Goldwater in 64. Hmm. Kind of led the way.
We have as our guest in this part of Focus 580 Marilyn Thompson. She has been a journalist for quite a while, an award-winning reporter in South Carolina, where she covered Strom Thurmond in the late 70s. After that, she worked for a number of years as assistant managing editor for investigations at the Washington Post. Then she went on to Kentucky, where she was the vice president and editor of the Lexington Herald Leader. And she is getting ready to move again. She's going to Washington, D.C., where she will become the national investigations editor of the L.A. Times, based in Washington, and she is the co-author of a biography of Strom Thurmond, and the book is titled Strom, The Complicated Personal and Political Life of Strom Thurmond, and it's published by Public Affairs. Questions welcome. We have a couple of people who'd like to get in on the conversation. That's certainly possible. All you have to do is give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. First caller is in Champaign, and line one. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
I totally agree with the young lady, and I want to give some background here. I grew up in South Carolina, and quite frankly, it was never a secret in South Carolina and with black people in South Carolina that Strom Thurmond had a black daughter. I know I went to school. I did my undergraduate work in Columbia, South Carolina. And for years, it was talked about that Strom Thurmond had a black daughter that went to South Carolina State College. And so it was never a secret. I don't think he changed his real views of racial issues in addition to that. But I want to make this or ask this question, and maybe it's a comment too. I want to know if the writer knew how old Strom Thurmond's mother was at the time when he was engaging with her on a intimate basis. I think she was very young, and I know the statutes of limitation have passed. But she was underage, and in South Carolina today, if you have sex with a underage individual, you go to jail. I just find it appalling that when we found that, when it became public, that no one brought up the fact that he raped her. Thank you for the opportunity to express that.
Sure. Well, Ms. Thompson, can you talk about that?
Yeah, I can talk about all of those points, starting with the first about the knowledge of this relationship in the South. He's absolutely right that this was a well-known story. It was a kind of a legend in South Carolina that Thurmond had a black daughter, or had a black child, to be more precise. For a long time, you didn't know whether it was a daughter or son. But there was no name connected to this for many, many years. I started on the trail of trying to identify who this person might be in the early 80s, and it took me literally several years of reporting to even get a name to attach to the rumor. And from that, I was able to then begin to document the relationship by going through Thurmond's gubernatorial archives. where I found some letters that S.E. Washington had written him from South Carolina State College. It was perhaps better known in the black community. There may have been a few more details circulating, but it was one of those stories that everybody talked about, but nobody could offer any real proof for many years. As to the question of Essie's mother, you know, there's no question this was a teenage girl. She was underage when they were having sexual relations. My view of it was always very similar to the caller's, that he had completely taken advantage of this girl who was working as a maid in the family household, and that, you know, there was no justification for it. I did quite a bit of research later on about the issue of the statutory rape laws in South Carolina, and it was still a little fuzzy whether this girl could qualify as someone who had been raped, given the nature of the relationship. It's very interesting that Miss Williams, in her book, which was a bestseller, talked about their relationship, and she completely believes that it was a long-lasting, loving relationship that began at a young age but continued for many, many years. And she bristled at the idea that this could be considered a rape.
And that is the daughter that you're talking about. She believed that it was a consensual relationship.
Yes, she believed that it was, as she said, a long-term relationship that, you know, continued from the teenage years of her mother through almost to the time of the mother's death.
Hmm. Do you, I suppose one of the questions for her was, and I'm sure that you asked and other people asked, when she, after Strom Thurmond died, and she for the first time confirmed publicly, yes, in fact, that she was his daughter, the question being, why was it that she waited to do that until after he was dead?
Well, you know, she confirmed that to me. I was the first reporter to get that story. And it was one of the crowning moments of my career, because I had first approached Miss Williams in 1984. I flew out to Los Angeles after having pieced together details of her life, and I approached her as she was teaching school at the time, and I knocked on the door of her schoolroom and asked if I could talk to her and ask her, you know, is this rumor true? And she absolutely denied it. She said that it was not true and that it was a rumor that had followed her but was completely unfounded. In 2003, when she decided to step forward and tell her story, her attorney tracked me down because she remembered this 1984 experience and I guess had followed my career somewhat and knew that I was then at the Washington Post. So she called me, out of the blue, to tell me that she was ready to tell the truth and that, yes, it was true that he was her father. Her rationale was that, you know, they had a great relationship and that they both understood that this was supposed to be kept quiet. My feeling, and again, I was much more cynical than Miss Williams ever was, my feeling was that she kept quiet because he made regular payments to her over the course of many, many years, offering her financial support for her family. And she needed that support. She was not a wealthy woman, and she had suffered many hardships in her life.
Well, as you mentioned, there were rumors about this that had followed Strom Thurmond for a long time. If it had been confirmed, if, say, during the time that he was still in the Senate, if she had come forward and said, I am the daughter of Strom Thurmond, and had told the story of how that happened, would that have been the end of his political career?
Oh, I think it would have, for sure. If people had believed her, and you know, that's the other question about race relations in America, if this black woman had stepped forward at that time, would she have been believed? She certainly had some documentation to show that he had given her financial support, But, you know, her, it would have been a hard sell for her at that particular point in time. And she didn't want to do it because during the height of his Senate career, Miss Williams had become a widowed mother of, you know, children who she needed to put through college. And she had high ambitions for all of her children, and they all were very successful. And, you know, she needed the help.
Let's take this other caller here. We have another one. Been patient with us here in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I got to turn my radio down. Okay. I just read John Adams recently, and I'm kind of into biography, so I look forward to reading Ms. Thompson's book on this long-lived politician. You started the program saying that, well, first of all, he's a very long-lived politician, so we don't have too many of those. Two things came up. One, he had his finger to the winds of his constituency. He had, probably that's why he stayed in for so long. And then the other idea is that he stood up for what he believes in. These are sort of contradictory. You know, having in his formative years, he was probably very much, you know, his he voted with for his constituency the way they felt, and his constituency over the years probably the attitudes in the Carolinas were changing over the years, and maybe his didn't change so much, but he went along with them. So what's wrong with a politician representing his constituency, and I'll quote the earlier caller, whether they're right or wrong?
Oh, I think there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's what politicians do. Thurman did it extremely well. And, you know, he made the adjustment to new racial attitudes at a point when he needed to make that adjustment in the early 60s. You know, you begin to see Thurman actually set precedents by bringing a black staffer onto his Senate staff. He named a federal judge, a black man in South Carolina, who just happened to be an old boyfriend of his African-American daughter. He named him to a federal judgeship. He did some things that, you know, were designed to win over that part of his constituency that had for many, many years gone completely unaddressed. I don't think there's anything wrong with any of that. He was a supreme political opportunist, and I guess you have to factor that into your assessment of him.
Well, what you're really saying is that it's not wrong to represent your constituency, even if in later years the constituency looks like they were wrong. It's just when you use the word opportunistic, it makes him look, well, I guess all good politicians should be opportunistic, because in a way that you're taking, that means you've got your finger to the wind for your constituency.
And there are some great stories in the book, some anecdotes of Thurman's ability to shift the winds and make a bold move at precisely the right time. One of the best stories is about the death of Senator Burnett Maybank, which was a very big deal in South Carolina. Maybank was a much-loved senator, and he died very suddenly. And Thurman and a number of other aspiring politicians in South Carolina literally went to Maybank's funeral, and they'd barely put the coffin in the ground before they were all rushing off to Columbia to try to snare the Democratic nomination for the Democratic place in the Senate that Maybank had left. It's just a very vivid story. And Thurman, you know, outsmarted everybody and actually won the right to go to the Senate because of his shrewd tactics. It may be the best compliment you could pay a politician to call him opportunistic.
Okay, well, you covered the ground, and I'll look forward to your book.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call.
Bye.
Well, I guess I'll own up to, I think I was the guy who used the term opportunist. Mostly, I guess I was thinking about his change of attitudes later in life. And I guess, again, the thing I was wondering about was, well, did that really reflect what he believed, or for whatever, whether it was national public opinion or maybe even the opinion of his constituents, whether that was changing and so he saw the need to change as a politician, but whether in his heart of hearts, whether his attitudes on race really changed.
Yeah.
Well, let's go on. And we have another caller here, Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, what we don't know is whether Trent Lott's opinions have changed yet since he was toasting Strom, wasn't he? And that, everything would have been different if he'd have won.
So said Senator Lott, yes.
Yeah. Actually, I wanted to call. I know it's a biography and you seem to be focusing on an individual, but I wonder whether you looked into sort of the cultural aspect of this, the idea that the domestics, you know, in a rich family, you know, this is not uncommon. This servicing the family household included many times servicing the young bucks of the family, et cetera, et cetera. This is not restricted just to the South. I think it happens anywhere where there's sort of domestic help. The Filipinos that fled Lebanon recently, and the ones that still in Saudi Arabia are pretty much at beck and call, it seems, in a lot of circumstances. So there's race and class interpenetrating there in an interesting way. And I can't remember. I don't think it was Bull Connors, but there's one story about one of the segregationists who, you know, passed out axe handles when they were trying to integrate a restaurant. And later in his life, he was ill, and the doctor said, "Sit down. You know, I have some bad news for you." And he says, "Doctor, is it cancer?" And he says, "No, it's sickle cell anemia." I forget who it was, but obviously, there's this. This goes back a long ways, and I just wonder, I know it's sort of a biography of Thurman as a politician, but I wonder whether you, either in the book or on your own, have any reflections on this whole idea of race and class and this kind of basically servitude that was reflected in this.
Well, we did look. We looked into it to the extent that it related to the South, and particularly the part of South Carolina where Thurman was raised and came of age. And you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, you can go into South Carolina, and it's kind of a known fact that many of the most prominent white families in South Carolina have their black relatives. And they either acknowledge them or don't, but it's a very well-known fact that this exists and that this is part of the culture there. We had some really interesting interviews in and around Edgefield, South Carolina, about the early 1900s and, you know, and the exploitation of young women in the domestic class in Edgefield. And you know, the mother of this child was just one of many who probably had the same sort of thing going on. We had a great story from a white man who grew up around the time of Thurman talking about you know, the spot on the river where you would take your buggy and take the young servant girls down to the riverside to actually do it. We have very vivid detail in the book, but I think that you've tapped into what could obviously be a much larger exploration. And another good book for someone to do, probably won't be me, but it's an interesting theme. And the Sally Hemings story, of course, as an overlay to all of that.
Yeah, there's still a lot of denial in that white family group.
Right.
There's also this apocryphal story of the father of our country who didn't have any children by Martha, but this is a story about how the X's in his diary reflected his conquest with his slave class. I don't know if any of his buddies researched that.
I know.
Thank you very much.
Waiting to be written, that's for sure.
Well, it is. I think you, the sections early in the book where you talk about what life must have been like around the turn of the last century in Edgefield, where he grew up. And you have to consider, Strom Thurmond was born in 1902. That really wasn't all that long after the end of the Civil War.
That's right. And we found a young woman out in San Francisco, African-American woman, who had done quite a bit of genealogical research and discovered that Thurman's, that she was related to Thurman's grandfather, who was a slave owner in the Edgefield area. So, you know, there are probably many more links here that could be established between the black and white parts of the Thurman clan.
We are past our midpoint here. We have some other callers we will get to, but I do again want to reintroduce our guest, Marilyn Thompson. She was an award-winning reporter in South Carolina, where she covered Strom Thurmond back in the late 70s. She then served 4 years as assistant managing editor and for investigation at the Washington Post, then went on to the Lexington Herald Leader, where she was vice president and editor, and now she's getting ready to move to Washington, where she will be the national investigations editor of the Los Angeles Times. She's the co-author, along with Jack Bass, of a biography of Strom Thurmond. It's titled Strom, The Complicated Personal and Political Life of Strom Thurmond, is published by Basic Books, or Public Affairs, pardon me, Basic Books, another fine publisher, but not the one for this book, Public Affairs. And this came out, I think, last year, and was an update of an earlier book that you did. And I think that in large part the reason for doing the new edition was to incorporate the story of Essie May.
Yeah.
And what you had learned. Subsequent and what happened after she publicly came out and said, yes, I am the daughter of Strom Thurmond.
Yes, because her acknowledgement of this and her providing of details about the relationship allowed us to go back into the archives at the Strom Thurmond Institute, Clemson University, and find many, many more documents explaining this relationship and how it worked. And so we were able to go in and write a number of new chapters, including material about Thurmond's last years in the Senate, the Trent Lott debacle, and Thurmond's death.
One of the questions that I'm sure many people raised, I'm not sure how publicly they raised the question, was at the end of his time in the Senate, which was close to the end of his life, was he truly capable of representing the people of South Carolina?
Well, my sources who watched him day in and day out on the Senate floor said that he was like any man of that age. We're talking someone who, you know, was 98, 99, 100 years old. He had moments of lucidity, and he kind of came and went, and there were times when you could talk to him, and he would actually give you a pretty profound answer, and other times where he didn't know what you were talking about. There was sort of a comic image of Thurmond, that comedy routines about Thurmond on the Senate floor, in which, you know, he was basically like a prop with his orange hair plugs and stooped over in his chair, making decisions on all kinds of major national issues. But I think that those exaggerated it a bit. I think he was lucid at least part of the time. He was living full-time at Walter Reed Hospital, so...
Well, were there people in his home state who were willing to say something like, you know, the senator has served us ably and well for a very long time. However, the time has come for him, with all honors due, for him to step down?
Well, there was a movement in that regard as Thurmond aged. And, you know, you would hear chatter about that in South Carolina, and you would hear talk of, you know, who could step in to replace him, and this would be the opportune time to do that while Republicans were still in control of the state. So there were some movements made to try to gently, delicately shove him out. But we're talking here about a man known for his huge ego and vanity, and Thurmond would no sooner have stepped down from that seat voluntarily than anything. He wanted to be remembered as the oldest, longest-serving member of that Senate, and he wasn't going to go until he absolutely had to.
Yeah, let's talk with some other callers. Someone this morning in Indiana, our line 4. Hello.
Hello. It's sort of my day. That fellow just came on and essentially asked the question I was going to ask.
So I'd like to spread it out a little bit this way. The next step to me after you answered that fellow's questions is what kind of mind perpetuates these kind of falsehoods about race and that sort of thing, and still wants to, I see it as opportunistic too, to see it sort of dip into the sexual lake and not be too concerned about anything. I know this has a long, long history with the masters and all that sort of thing, but still, it still leaves ashes in my mouth to think about somebody who could do that and still, you know, since examine himself in the mirror in the mornings. I wonder if you could talk to that in any extent whatsoever. You know, I think there's a lot of guys who fit into this grouping, whatever it might be, and the whole thing just appalls me. I understand about that we have to be sensitive to the cultural period and stuff like that, but unfortunately, when it comes to ethics, I'm pretty black and white. Whether in 3000 B.C. it was wrong to have slaves, it's still wrong now, and that sort of thing. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
I can tell you my own personal opinion on this issue, and it's one of the reasons that, you know, it really drove me to continue to pursue the story of the black daughter. I had embarked on a biography of Thurman, not knowing whether this black daughter story was true or not, or whether it would really be important or not. And the more that I dug into the many aspects of Thurman's life back in the, you know, early 80s, I realized that to leave this thread unexplored, this idea that a man known as perhaps the leading segregationist of his time was secretly harboring a black daughter to whom he was sending payments regularly and yet not acknowledging her publicly, not letting his feelings for her penetrate any of his racist comments on the Senate floor. I just didn't feel that I could let go of it until it had been proven once and for all. And it almost drove me crazy because it was a very tough story to break. But I felt very strongly that this kind of hypocrisy needed to be documented.
Yeah. Well, so as you say, and the thing that obviously he will be remembered for, he would have been remembered anyway for his long career for being a strong supporter of segregation and opponent of civil rights, for having run for president in 1947.
1948.
1948. Running for president in 1948 as a candidate of the what popularly known as the Dixiecrat Party, which had this strong anti-civil rights segregationist character to it. So, you know, all of that. And then this very, very interesting wrinkle that comes after his death where the rumors are confirmed. So those things are going to go hand in hand. He would have been remembered, again, for those other things anyway, for strong opposition to civil rights. As you, though, you look at his long career, is there anything to balance that against? It's something that, you know, maybe it doesn't make sense to try to grab onto something that's sort of positive, but, I mean, can you indeed find some things to balance against that?
Well, I guess it depends on you know, how you feel, how strongly you feel about that particular theme. My co-author, it's very interesting, my co-author, who is male and who is a little bit older than I am, he had a very forgiving attitude toward Thurman, and he felt that, you know, Thurman really had changed his position on race and that he really did treat Essie in a humane way throughout her lifetime, and that considering the limitations of the time and the culture, Thurman had done a pretty good job with all of this race stuff. I just felt extremely differently about it, and part of it was that, you know, I was a woman, and that I did feel that there had been extreme exploitation of this young servant, and then a complete denial by Thurman for many years of this daughter's existence, and I just found it appalling. Are there things that could balance your view of him? Yes. I mean, he did, as we've discussed, change the landscape of the South politically and move it toward the Republican Party. And he did a lot of favors for a lot of people in South Carolina, brought a lot of improvements to the state. that could certainly be credited to him and to his political prowess on the Hill. So
yeah.
That's kind of my opinion.
Yeah, I suppose he also was one of these guys who was really famous for voting against everything, all kinds of federal spending, voting against
yeah.
tax, all that. And then as soon as he was done with that, turning around and squeezing every little bit of pork he could for
he was a pork king
for the state. So again, that goes back to the thing we were talking about at the beginning, where his one of the keys to his success was constituent service.
Right. And even from his first years in the Senate, I mean, there were sort of comical stories about how some, you know, fairly minuscule grant would be announced for some place in South Carolina, and Thurman would show up at the announcement and almost, you know, literally just elbow the people out of the photo op so that he would be at the center of it. You know, he took credit for all of this stuff.
Hmm. Well, let's try and talk with some more folks here. Vermilion County is our next caller. This is line three.
Hi.
Hi.
I remember when a number of years ago, he married a woman much younger than he, and Nancy. And I wondered if you could talk about his marriages and his children and how the ages of these children relate to this daughter that you were talking about.
Oh, certainly. Thurman was married twice. His first wife, ironically, was sort of the same syndrome. He married a woman who he was 44 years old, and she had just graduated from college, and he brought her to work in his gubernatorial office as an aide, and literally proposed to her while he was pretending to dictate a letter in his office. And her name was Jean Thurman. She died of brain cancer in 1960, and she was a wonderful part of Thurman's early years in the Senate. People really loved and respected her. She had a great personality, and she served him well politically. They had no children, but it was certainly during this time of the courtship and marriage to Jean that S.C. Washington sort of surfaced in Thurman's life. Thurman had helped her get a slot at South Carolina State College in Orangeburg, and she was going to school there, and Thurman and Jean would sometimes go to visit the campus, and Thurman would have secret meetings with the black daughter. So Jean must have known about this. That's my opinion, although there was no documentation to prove it. Nancy came along much later in Thurman's life. She was 44 years younger than he was. It was very controversial, almost scandalous in South Carolina for someone to marry someone that much younger than them. But Thurman consulted his advisors, and again, man of his convictions, he told them, you know, I don't care what people think, I'm going to do this. And he married this young woman, and much to the dismay of the naysayers, you know, people accepted it. And they started finding great humor in Thurman's virility at that age because they immediately produced four children. It is unclear to me whether Thurman's family with Nancy ever really knew about the existence of S.E. Washington Williams until 2003, when she stepped forward to publicly state that it was true. The family, to its credit, at first they denied it, and then about a day later, the son, Strom Jr., had a press conference to acknowledge that, yes, this was the case. So it was a very interesting family saga, that's for sure.
Does that, Colin, does that get your question?
Sure, thanks.
All right, let's go to line number two. This is Urbana. Hello.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think for any of us to think that Strom Thurman was a great man, it only suggests that we like to talk about today about morality and family and all of those great cliches that Republicans like to wrap their flag around. This man was an immoral racist from the from the time he knew about how much he hated blacks until he died. And to put this man on any kind of pedestal, I find it tremendously appalling. And the reason why the daughter thought that it was a great relationship between her and her and her mother, it's obvious. He was paying her extortion money, although she wasn't trying to get that out of it, but it worked for both of them. Strom Thurmond was an immoral man, and it just reeks with, we like to talk about the moral decay today, but just think about, there are many stories like that of people that represent us in Congress that it appalls us. It appalls me. But I am so glad this lady wrote her book. And your co-author, that is the typical reaction of many, is that we want to forgive. How do you forgive somebody like that, who's supposed to be a leader in our country, fighting for those morals and values that we have? That was he was an immoral man. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the comment. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
I'll just make a brief comment, which is I always go back to an interview that I did with a woman named Majeska Simpkins, who was one of the early civil rights leaders in South Carolina. And she granted me a very long interview. This was quite early in my research on Thurmond. And we sat out on her porch and talked for, you know, 3 or 4 hours about Thurmond. She despised Thurmond. She considered him an evil force who had basically, in running for Dixiecrat in 1948, he had soured race relations in America for decades, and she would not forgive him, and she hated him vigorously. And I will never forget listening to her story and how she felt about him. And at the end of the interview, she was the one who planted with me this obsession, because at the end of the interview she said, "You know he has a black daughter, don't you?" And I will never forget my feeling at that time that, if true, this was the ultimate hypocrisy.
After his service in World War II, he took part in the D-Day invasion, was highly decorated, actually, as a veteran, came back, went to law school, became a lawyer, then became a judge. And then it was after that that he ran his first run for office was as the governor of South Carolina. What made him want to go into politics instead of, you know, whatever else? He could have gone on to become a lawyer. You know, he could have done a number of things, probably.
Well,
what drew him to politics, do you think?
His father, Will Thurmond, was sort of a failed politician. He had wanted to run for office, and in fact, he had been the right-hand man of the notorious race baiter, Pitchfork Ben Tillman, who's something of a legend in South Carolina. A real hate monger for the black people, against the black people of the South. And Will Thurmond had never succeeded in his quest for office because he actually shot a man in downtown Edgefield in a duel. His honor had been attacked, and he reached out and, you know, pulled a pistol and shot the man dead there in the town square, and had to stand trial on this, and was acquitted. And it was a very, very famous case, but it kind of ruined Will Thurmond's political ambitions. But he took Strom under his wing at a very early age, took him with him to visits with Ben Tillman, and Ben Tillman actually taught Strom how to shake hands. And as Strom once put it to me, he said, "You know, I started shaking when I was 6 years old, and I've been shaking ever since." And he learned from the master, because Tillman was another of the constituent service masters. But he had politics in the blood. There's no question about it. And he wanted office from the time he was old enough to run. He actually didn't go to law school, just to make that little note. He studied law under his father's tutelage and passed the bar you know, independent of going to law school. So he, you know, he had the background that his father had given him.
Yeah. It's remarkable the number of firsts and records this man holds, the oldest person ever to be in the Senate. Robert Byrd has now passed his length of service, but he had this very long service. He was the only person ever to be elected to the Senate as a write-in.
Yes, he was.
And still continues to hold this record for the longest filibuster by an individual senator. I imagine a lot of these things, it may be sometime, if ever, that anyone ever breaks these records.
Yes, it would take kind of a demonic force to break the filibuster record, because that was just quite a legend.
That seems I don't know how one would. He spoke for over 24 hours.
Yes, he did, and you know, there are many, many stories about how they managed to get Thurman through that 24 hours. He had a whole strategy set up so that he never had to leave the floor, even if he needed to, like, duck into the cloakroom to take a leak. You know, it was just amazing, the folklore that surrounded this historic event. But he stood there and he read everything from the U.S. Constitution to the Declaration of Rights, and, you know, read and read and read for 24 hours and 18 minutes. I doubt that anyone will break that record.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our filibuster is over for the second hour of Focus. Our guest, Marilyn Thompson, she is going on to Washington, D.C. to become the National Investigations Editor of the L.A. Times. Before that, she spent some time as the Vice President and Editor of the Lexington Herald Leader and covered Strom Thurmond for many years as a reporter in South Carolina in the late 70s. And the book, if you'd like to read it, is Strom, The Complicated Personal and Political Life of Strom Thurmond, published by Public Affairs. Ms. Thompson, thank you.
Thank you so much.